Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. This is the, gotta get this right, the fourth anniversary episode. I've been doing this now for 4 years, and like all the anniversary episodes, Ruth Kinna, author of, and I brought the book here, I always get the title wrong, The Government of No One, and many other books, and of course, many appearances on this podcast, is here once again. Ruth, thank you for doing this every year. It's such a pleasure.
It really is a pleasure for me, too.
Well, another pleasure that we experienced was I had a chance through my university work to travel to the United Kingdom twice in the past 12 months. And both times you were kind enough to meet with me and chat, and I believe bought my meals both times. So thank you for that. And when we were meeting in December, I guess it was December of 2024.
Yeah.
It turned out that both of us are big fans of Hollywood Westerns. And Hollywood Westerns, I mean, I've got a lot to say about them. I'm sure we both do. I'll try and sprinkle it in as we go, make this a conversation, not just a lecture. But Hollywood Westerns are a really interesting genre for political scientists. I mean, there are reams and reams of books, because among their many narratives in Hollywood Westerns is, how does one create a community? How does one obtain consent? How does one deal with the savages outside of civilization? Or, in fact, are the civilizing conquerors the true savages? Yeah. This comes up. What is the role of violence? Is violence necessary to create peace? Is Hobbes right? I mean, these movies are, the good ones at least, the more interesting ones, are themselves documents of political theory, although to the best of my knowledge, they're not generally analyzed by anarchist theorists. At least I haven't seen it. So I thought we would do it, and I asked you if you would, and you said yes. So thank you.
And so, yeah, I mean, I guess it's Westerns are dangerous ground for anarchists, aren't they? I mean, the reputation of the Western was always that it was a very sort of conservative sort of art form. And I guess as I became more aware of, as I got older watching Westerns, I mean, like, Westerns were sort of one of the staples of Saturday night viewing when I was a child. And as I got older, I became aware of the number of sort of writers and, I mean, screenwriters who had started to make Westerns after being blacklisted. So Westerns became a vehicle for quite a lot of experimentation and for quite a lot of critique. And I think, I mean, the other thing that comes across for me in the Western is a lot of the stories are about, you know, the building of America, you know, the move west and the building of America, and so those issues of sort of justice and law and order and the man of justice. I mean, this becomes such a kind of like a central trope, doesn't it, in the Western? Apart from then also the killing that goes on, the colonization and all the rest.
I agree. I was certainly taught the Western was a right-wing form, and then sort of film noir is its sort of left-wing counterpart. And this is, of course, I mean, there's senses that it's true, but for one thing, the Western and the film noir get intertwined after World War II. A lot of the Westerns are dark, both psychologically dark, but I mean, are shot dark. It's not the beautiful, bright, open anymore. And the one of the most famous Westerns, The Searchers, is about a deranged man who is supposedly out to save his niece, but is in fact seems to be trying to murder his niece. And this is clearly a noir inflected thing. Oh. So yeah, I agree. So here's my literary historian comes in. So the Western, when we trace the Western, when literary scholar, American literary scholars, of which I am one, trace the Western, we generally start it with these early 19th century writers by this guy, James Fenimore Cooper.
Right.
So they're set in New York, because they're set in the 18th century, but what they are about is settlers moving west and encountering Indians and Law and Order, because that was the that was the West then. And the hero of these tales, Leatherstocking tales, Natty Bumppo, he's a white man. He's on the side of the colonizers, but also he has learned the ways of the Indians. His friends are Indians. He prefers Indian culture. And yet, because of progress or whatever, he participates in the destruction of Indian culture, even as he objects to it. So going back almost 200 years, I mean, I think those things came out in the 1820s, the Western has been ambivalent. It's not a straightforward tale, or at least it didn't begin, and it did not continue, of, you know, white progress good, evil Indians bad. It's had an elegiac, mournful, bittersweet tone all the way. I mean, the Indians are almost always killed. It's almost always like inevitable, but you might not like it, you know? And that, I think that surprises people who assume that Westerns are just a story of white imperialism. They are a story of white imperialism most of the time.
Yeah, but not actually. They don't, they're not all celebrating it or just taking it as part of a necessary act in order to as you say, to civilize the land or to make it productive or whatever it is. I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, and there are films that celebrate it, certainly. But the one, so we've talked about, there's a lot of Westerns that will probably come up, but there's two that you and I watched recently. They probably both deserve an introduction, but for now I'll just mention them. One is called Fort Apache, and that's very much a Western about you know, civilization coming, and the U.S. cavalry is heroic. But just like in The Searchers and just like in Leatherstocking Tales, the heroic cavalryman, played by John Wayne, who was in real life a very uncomplicated right-wing racist figure. Like, his characters are much more complicated than the man himself. John Wayne, I have nothing good to say about him as a person. Sorry. I heard he was a very nice man. Very polite. So he knows Cochise and Geronimo, and he admires them, and he says they are doing the right thing, and the U.S. government is the villain. So this is 1948, and John Wayne's character is siding with the Indians over the U.S. government.
So the other star of the film is Henry Fonda. They're both playing against type.
Yes.
So whereas Fonda would normally be the, you know, the kind of the guardian of liberal values. I mean, Fonda is this kind of uptight, bureaucratic, jealous, disciplinarian, and John Wayne, as you say, is this man who understands the country, understands the Indian respects. I mean, he calls Cochise chief.
Yes.
When he meets him, he respects him as a military man and as a man of honor and integrity. And none of these things does the Henry Fonda character accept. I mean, for Henry Fonda, you know, it's preposterous to think that, I mean, Henry Fonda sort of says, you know, what you're suggesting is that Cochise has the sort of the strategy of Alexander the Great or Napoleon. You know, this is completely preposterous because this man must be a barbarian. And as a result of the refusal of Fonda to listen to John Wayne, he meets a pretty nasty end. I mean, it's later presented to you as heroic, but he suffers at the hands of the Indians because he miscalculates. But the other interesting thing for me about the John Wayne character, who is sort of, as you say, sort of respectful of his of the Indians, who sympathizes with the reason that they've left the reservation, which is the reason why the cavalry are, you know, trying to get them back, back, not just on the reservation, but back under authority. He understands that, he sympathizes with it, but he's not sympathetic to Indian culture. He just sees them as a noble enemy.
Yeah.
So at the end, actually, the kind of the message is that, you know, we can't have the army being run by, these rule-bound buffoons like Henry Fonda, what we have to have is the man of initiative and determination and understanding and intelligence. That's the only way we're going to beat our foes. But we meet our foes as equals. So, you know, because we won't win otherwise. If we think that they're all stupid, then they're going to outfox us. And that's the kind of lesson of the film. But it's perfectly okay to kill the Indians. I mean, you know, that's what the cavalry does. And at the end of the film, and I think the film is made during the war.
I think it's a few years later. I think it's like 47, 48, right, something
okay.
like that.
But I mean, it's inflected with that kind of wartime mm-hmm. spirit, if you like. And one of the things that comes across quite strongly in the film is that, I mean, the Henry Fonda character gets credit in the end for having sort of forged this kind of rather sort of undisciplined troop into a fighting force, because he has taught them, you know, the values of discipline and all the rest of it, even if he didn't do it very well. But one of the things that comes across is that, you know, it's not the individuals that make the difference in this war. It's the flag. It's the combined force of the American army that's going to win out over this kind of pesky foe. But I suppose it's sort of, as a film, because it elevates Cochise as a sort of a worthy opponent, it doesn't denigrate the Indians, but at the same time, nor does it take a critical view of ultimately the colonization of the Indian territory.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I should mention now, the man who made this film, the director, his name was John Ford. He's probably no one's ever going to catch him for most successful director in Hollywood history, because he made fantastic films from the silent era through the 60s. He won 4 Academy Awards. He received 0. He never went to the Academy Awards. So he's the perfect, like, central figure who is also an iconoclast who denies many of the, you know, features of the genre. And when it comes time to characterize him ideologically, it's impossible. His two most beloved leading men were the right-wing icon John Wayne and the left-wing icon Henry Fonda, as you say, both in this movie cast against type, although again the you know, imperialism wins out at the end completely. He makes John Ford makes The Grapes of Wrath, which is one of the most important left-wing books and left-wing films ever made. He is strongly pro-Indian in many ways, and he films all of his films, or almost all of his westerns, in Monument Valley, where he's just a total benefactor to the Navajo people who live there. He also does not allow speaking parts to go to Indians. All of the Indians who have speaking roles in all of his films, I mean, I think a few of them are white American actors in quite lamentable red face, but almost all of them are actually Mexican or Mexican-American actors. Why he creates noble Indian characters but then refuses to let Indians play them, no one has ever figured out. It's just a bag of contradictions. John Ford is he loves the military, the U.S. military. He hates bureaucracy, you know, which the U.S. military is one of the great. I don't think people have spent their lives trying to figure out where John Ford fits in left, right, conservative, liberal, that sort of thing. And I think this film is a great example of how you're not going to figure it out.
Yeah. There's a sort of sense in which it's, you know, because there is a complete lack of commentary really in the end. I mean, it all gets concertinaed. So, I mean, the Wayne character is the one that survives and who takes over the command of the of Fort Apache, and by the time he does that, actually he's had Henry Fonda's blessing. Henry Fonda realizes that actually he's completely miscalculated. But then the story kind of reverts back then to this sub theme that runs through the film, which is the love story between Henry Fonda's daughter, played by Shirley Temple, an adult Shirley Temple, I should say, and the son of one of the other officers, non-commissioned officers at the camp. So there's a one of the other sort of themes that runs through it is Henry Fonda's class bias against the non-commissioned officer or the son of the non-commissioned officer, even though he's a West Point graduate. And that's his kind of like jealousy that this guy is, you know, he's kind of been elevated on his merit as opposed to on the basis of his family connections. And it kind of, yeah, you get this sort of, the film goes back to this sort of love story between the two of them. And then Henry Fonda is sort of commemorated, or the Henry Fonda character is commemorated in this portrait. And you're not quite clear whether John Wayne is just going along with the idea of celebrating him as a hero, or actually he does come round to the idea that he has done some kind of good. But there's a sort of, I suppose, there's a sort of realist edge to all of this in the end. The film pulls out this idea of the, you know, the people who died alongside Henry Fonda because of Henry Fonda's stupidity, you know, of course they're dead, but you know, John Wayne reassures us, you know, but they still live, and they still live in the force of the regiment.
Yeah, and you're right about the flag. It's a bureaucratic entity. Like, the John Wayne seems to be against bureaucratic entities for most of the movie, and then he's like, "Oh well, you know, as long as the 31st Regiment, or I don't remember the 9th or whatever, number exists, and there's a flag, then he will always be alive in our hearts, even though the guy was an asshole.
Yeah,
who got everyone killed?
Yeah, that's right. Which is bizarre. But the other thing that struck me when I watched it again recently was the character of the, I assume that there was a kind of like a, I mean, I don't know the history well enough, but the guy Meacham, he runs the outpost, I mean, the supply store on the reservation. And he's he's presented as a government appointee.
They're called Indian agents, is what they're called. Indian agents. So these, for just to fill in a bit from my place as the American culture scholar, the U.S. Department of Interior is in charge of the reservations. And frankly, it's fascinating from an anarchic perspective, because it is to this day not clear, and has never been clear, whether the reservations are sovereign in and of themselves, or are they subject? They're not subject to the states. So if there's a reservation that's contained within the state of Oklahoma, the governor of Oklahoma has no power on that reservation. The United States government certainly has more power there than it does in, you know, any other country than, say, Mexico or China, or name any country, but also less than it does in, you know, in the state of Oklahoma. And so these reservations have been, I mean, Emerson gets involved in this debate. These reservations have been both United States territory and not United States territory for as long as they have existed, for as long as the United States has existed. And the people who run them, they're called Indian agents, or they were then. I'm sure they're called something else now. They're bureaucrats in the Department of the Interior who are assigned to make sure that the reservation has, you know, the food and blankets it needs. Fry bread, the famous American Indian dish, is invented because Indian agents are, I don't know how true this is, but this is the story. Supposedly, often the government delivers good supplies, and the Indian agents are corrupt and sell them and just deliver, you know, lard and flour. And so fry bread is what you can make if all you have is lard and flour. And this film goes along with the standard narrative of the 19th century Indian agent, that the Indian agent is the classic middleman, like a bureaucratic rentier who swindles and steals, basically the ultimate landlord who is unaccountable because the government stands behind him. Sorry, go ahead.
So he has a very minor part in this film, in terms of, you know, his screen time and his lines, but actually he's quite an important character in it, because he's the reason that Cochise has led the Indians off the reservation, because he says, you know, what's going on here is not just that we're being, you know, this man is a swindler, but he's basically poisoning us with his trinkets, his he's not giving us food, he's selling us stuff that we don't need, and he calls it trinkets. I mean, it's just sort of trash, and his alcohol. And to underline the point about the alcohol, I mean, because you know, the only sort of characters that you meet apart from the lead players in the film, the only characters in the troupe you meet, they're all Irish, Irish descent. And to underline the fact of how sort of bad this hooch is that's being sold on the reservation, because they all get blind drunk on it, and Henry Fonda refuses to drink it because it's just sort of, I mean, just, you know, it's not real whiskey, it's just alcohol. So, but the other interesting thing about this character is that he presents himself as an egalitarian. So he says, I make no distinction between, yeah, we're all brothers. I mean, one of the first lines he has, we're all brothers here, you know, and that includes my Indian brothers. I don't care who I exploit.
Yeah.
You know, you, Henry Fonda and the army, you should leave me alone, because I'm running this on my own lines, and I'm allowed to do so, and I bear no responsibility for the response or the consequences of what I'm doing. And yet at the same time, having presented himself as, I mean, so he is the sort of the, you know, the as you say, the sort of the rentier type, the capitalist commercial exploiter, someone who really doesn't give a damn as long as they make money. He doesn't care for the well-being of the Indians. He cares only for his own profits, really. And then, having sort of declared himself an egalitarian and we're all brothers under the sun, he then says, well, of course, you know, but these people are primitive. So there is also this sort of underlying racism that he stands by. And yet this is presented to you. And again, no one takes him up. I mean, all of this is just, I mean, that's one of the things that's really good about the film, I think, that, you know, you're left to join the dots. You know, it doesn't, a lot of Westerns do moralize, but this one doesn't, which is why I think there is a kind of a realist edge to it. There's a sort of, you know, I'm just going to present you with these, with this situation and these different responses to the situation. I leave it to you to make up your mind, except the end when we get, you know, the patriotism creeps back in. That's the only point, I think, at which it moralizes.
Yeah, so I want to go to the end in a second, but I just want to stipulate one more thing. If you haven't seen the film, and also you should watch the film. I'll make sure to put notes that you should watch the film if you're listening to this in the show notes. Maybe I'll send an email out a week before. Watch these Westerns before the show comes out. We'll see if that leads to a dash to watching Ford Apache.
Yeah, well, there are too many spoilers, I think.
Yes, I think you spoiled it, which you can't discuss a film seriously without spoiling it. Meacham, whatever his name is, the Bureau of Indian Affairs bureaucrat, he is also selling the rifles. And in fact, they're repeating rifles. They're nicer rifles than the cavalry itself has. So where does Cochise get his rifles to fire on the cavalry and kill Henry Fonda? He gets them from the Indian agent, from the U.S. government. And then what's worse is Cochise agrees to end the war. I mean, yeah. This is now we're heading towards the complexity in the ending. Cochise agrees to end the war and says, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. War is terrible. The only thing worse than war is this bureaucrat. So as long as you fire him, I'll come back and we'll end the war. And John Wayne is ready to do that deal. And Fonda says, no, this man represents the U.S. government. Sovereignty trumps everything. The U.S. government gets to put him in charge. You don't get to have any say in this because of the sovereign United States of America.
And because you're inherently untrustworthy, Cochise.
Exactly.
You can't trust him. He has no sense of duty or anything.
And that is, I mean, that's again like connect connect the dots there. Yeah. And then Fonda is killed by the guns sold by the untrustworthy man. And the guns are used by the eminently trustworthy Cochise. I mean, that is...
Yeah.
And we could end the movie right there and we would all be like, what a beautiful anti-imperialist story. The imperialist got what was coming for him, and the good cavalryman, John Wayne, can negotiate a truce now that he's that he's dead.
But
that's not what happens.
That's not what happens.
And I should also say, before we go on to the ending, let me tell you the actual historical ending. Cochise and Geronimo both die in their beds. The war is, in fact, ended. The prospect of eternal bloodshed that seems to leave the end at the end of the movie, that doesn't actually happen. This massacre is basically the Little Bighorn massacre. Yeah. It ripped out of history and moved to a slightly different time and place. But this ending that the war will just go on forever until Cochise is defeated, that's not what happens. The truce actually is agreed to, and both Geronimo and Cochise, they're not martyrs. They live the rest of their life. So Ford has given a more militaristic, less compromising end to the movie than actually happens in history.
There's sort of two things strike you. One is the sort of the so actually everybody is kind of, you know, it's kind of sucked up into this ridiculous system where your businessmen are selling arms to both sides in order for for the system to sort of keep perpetuating it. So, yeah, that's all good profit. And maybe that doesn't happen anymore within the confines of a territorial state, but it certainly happens globally. I mean, that's exactly what happens.
Sure.
But the finality of the defeat that's intimated at the end, that, you know, John Wayne is going to go and fight the war against the Indians. I mean, so if that's not actually what happens in that instance, that is kind of what happens in the generality of things.
Well, yeah.
And that creates a sort of more of a question mark, perhaps, than I'd sort of anticipated when I saw it.
What I would say is, you know, the Apache lose the war. There's no doubt about that, but they lose the war precisely through the sort of agreement that Fonda throws away. We will return to the reservation.
Yeah.
It is a surrender. It is not an extermination by the cavalry. I mean, of course, many, many, many Apache are killed by the cavalry, but the group does come in and agree to terms precisely the way that that John Wayne's character wants to happen. And Cochise is like, you know, I don't like this, but I've got to end the war, both in the film and in real life.
Yeah.
And there's definitely, I mean, we don't see what happens at the end of this movie, but I agree with you. There's the implication that Cochise is going to die.
Yeah.
And so is Geronimo, and there will be no Apaches left on the face of the earth.
Yeah, or there will be no peace.
Yes.
There will be a victory,
yes,
and it's going to be under the flag.
Right.
I think that's how I read it. I mean, there were two other things that struck me. One, right at the end of the film, so the John Wayne character throughout the film has been wearing a rather kind of loose uniform, so just the shirt and a kind of kerchief and a hat, but not a sort of like a smart uniform, which is what Henry Fonda sort of wears the whole of the film. At the end of the film, because, you know, John Wayne, having taken over Fort Apache, now appears in the dress, almost like the dress uniform. And the love interest who goes off with Henry Fonda's daughter, Shirley Temple, he now wears the John Wayne outfit. So the West Point guy ends up as the adjunct, and his value, having been based on West Point, now seems to be tied, if you like, to he's the innate intelligence that he's going to pick up from being under a, you know, a brilliant leader like John Wayne. So there's a kind of leadership story that goes on there. And the other thing that really struck me is that one of the first things you see when Henry Fonda goes out to Fort Apache is he's absolutely, he loathes the idea that he's being sent to the back of beyond. He sees no opportunity in this country, in this land. He just sees this as an exile, a demotion. He thinks it has absolutely no value at all. He just doesn't want to be there. And that's quite odd for a Western.
Yeah. So a couple of things in response to both of those. So first of all, it does seem like as the film is progressing, it seems like the movie is kind of trying to argue that, as you said earlier, you have to have, you know, if you really want the military to get the job done, then they have to be in some ways an anarchic force, a guerrilla force. Oh. They can't be split and polished. They can't be following orders. They can't care about hierarchy and rank. But the end of the film suggests that they actually have to have both of these elements. They need to have some free-thinking, creative men with the skill of Cochise and other iron-booted military men, and this fusion of bureaucratic, hierarchical buffoonery and, you know, hard-won smarts that resembles the skills of the Indian. That's the true nature of the army.
Yeah,
you have to have both.
Yeah,
and once John Wayne is in charge, he switches uniforms.
Yeah,
and
once
the West Point guy is the second in command, he's going to be riding off.
He's going to be the slightly disruptive one.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Cool.
And now I've forgotten. I had a point to your second point, but I don't remember what was.
Being posted to the back of beyond as a kind of punishment.
Yes. Yes. So, and I just want to say that this changes for those who haven't seen the film. Is he? John Wayne mentions Cochise. And Fonda basically says, Cochise, I've read about him in the newspapers. You know, the man who attacks Cochise will become
famous.
So what transforms the backwater for him is realizing that Cochise is famous. So he has no respect for Cochise.
No.
But as long as the Eastern newspaper men treat Cochise as an important figure in world history, well then...
Yeah, and he gets his wish because in the end, I mean, who is John Wayne speaking to at the last shot? It's the press.
It's the new Eastern newspaper men have come out because Henry Fonda has become a famous legend a la Custer. All right, so the last thing we need to talk about is... I mean, John Ford has made a few very, very famous films, obviously The Grapes of Wrath, but one that gets talked about frequently is this later Western with Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne again, called The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Uh-huh.
And that movie concludes with an ending about the press getting... I won't spoil that movie, but with the press getting... the legend wrong, and then the press has learned they've gotten the legend wrong, and famously, you know, when they say when the legend becomes truth, print the legend. So the press has decided to lie about Western history in order to tell a better and more valiant story. That ending, I think, is not widely known to have also happened in this film Fort Apache, which is at least 15 years
before.
15 years before, the press is not in on it. And the real question is, John Wayne is spouting, as you say, all of these claims. Yes, he really made this company what it is, this Henry Fonda character. He died so valiantly. He was so brave. You know that this is a lie.
Yeah.
Wayne knows it's a lie. John Ford knows it's a lie.
Yeah. No, the question is whether John Wayne's going to go along with it.
Yes. And he did.
Because it's for the good of the military.
Yes. And it just seems like once that's the choice between savagery and civilization, we might admire Cochise a lot more than we admire Colonel Thursday, who is an asshole and an idiot. Who is against American values of democracy and doesn't believe that people should be allowed to rise above their station. I mean, he is against the essence of...
Yeah, he's an aristocrat.
The essence of American democracy as John Ford understood it.
Yeah.
And I guess
that's why the Irish heritage also plays well in that sense.
Yes. So Ford has a movie... I'm not going to get the title of it, so I won't say the title of it right, but it has Spencer Tracy, and he's playing an Irish politician running for like his fourth straight term as mayor of Boston. And there's people conspiring against them, and he bursts, it's the city aristocrats, and he bursts in the room to confront them, and they're literally meeting in the Cotton Mather room, and it's surrounded by portraits of Puritans, of 17th century Puritans, and he's like, this is what I'm up against.
Yeah.
The heiress, I've brought Irish dynamism to this country, and you assholes just want to pretend like it's 1617, and all that matters is Calvinism.
Yeah.
And so Ford would have had no tolerance for that sort of aristocracy. But the other, so people often say there's two parts of America that, you know, Ford is always celebrating. One is the military and the other is Irish Americans.
Right.
And so when Irish Americans end up in the military, it doesn't matter the aristocracy, the buffoonery, the colonialism, the imperialism. That's what wins out.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
All right. I think we did it. Any last thoughts before we move on to our next movie?
No, let's go on to the next one. No, I've seen it twice relatively recently, Fort Apache, and you see different things each time. It's such a good film.
It's a brilliant movie.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant movie. It's black and white.
Yeah.
It's in what's called the Academy ratio, meaning it's not widescreen. John Wayne and John Ford. And I should say the cinematography is by Greg Toland, who did Citizen Kane.
Okay.
And it just looks so good. I mean, Monument Valley looks so good.
Looks terrific.
John Wayne and Henry Fonda, they are movie stars, and they are shot like movie stars. Let me also mention before I go on that there is a documentary, it's kind of making the festival rounds now, called Henry Fonda for President, about the left-wing legacy of Henry Fonda and what we make of it these days, now that that sort of social democrat FDR New Deal thing has fallen through. And I interviewed the director, and so there'll be a whole interview about the legacy of Henry Fonda. But the film hasn't come out yet in the United States. They've asked me to keep it until then. We can take a break, Ruth. Do you need to deal with someone?
That's right. There's some noise outside.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I understand. So the other film we wanted to talk about is called Rancho Notorious.
Yeah.
It's a contrast in so many ways. First of all, it's in color. But mostly what's interesting for me to just jump off with my introduction, and I'll let you get rolling on it is made not by, you know, the most successful American film of all time, but by the man who's probably still the most successful German filmmaker of all time, Fritz Lang. He invents the serial killer movie, this film called M, which may also be, you know, the inventing the noir as well. You know, Paul Schrader says that the noir really gets started in America in the 40s, but also that one of the key influences of it is German expressionism. So Fritz Lang is similar to John Ford in his role in filmmaking. And Lang tells a story that's not quite true, which is that in 1933, Goebbels invites him to sort of take over German film production and be in charge of Nazi film production and that Long leaves that night. Now, that's a lie. We know that he stayed in Germany for a few months in terms of that night, but the rough version is true. Goebbels does want Fritz Long to work for the Nazis, and unlike some other filmmakers, Fritz Long, within 6 months, goes to France and then Hollywood, and in Hollywood, he makes a number of anti-fascist movies, including there's one called Hangmen Also Die, which was written by Bertolt Brecht and is about the assassination of Hitler's top lieutenant. I'm blanking on the guy's name. He's ruling Czechoslovakia at the time. Heydrich. Yeah. So it's a film about the murder of Heydrich written by Bertolt Brecht. So Fritz Long seems to have been a bit of a dictator on the film set, but he's very easy, at least in terms of fascist or not fascist, to align his politics. Anyone who collaborated with Brecht on a film about murdering Nazis is okay in my book. And then this film, Rancho Notorious, is one of the many movies he made when he was in his Hollywood exile and features another towering German figure, Marlene Dietrich, in the female role. And I'd seen this film a while ago. I watched it again when you mentioned it. I absolutely loved it. So again, I'll let you, that's my introduction. So what do you want to tell us about Rancho Notorious?
This is made a bit later. It's about 52, I think 53.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I mean, it's a kind of vehicle for Marlene Dietrich. I mean, she is the central character in the film. And she is terrific. I mean, she's just amazing. But it's a curious film because there is a kind of a plot line. So it starts off with the lead character Vern, who's about to get married to his sweetheart, and it's a very kind of sentimental beginning. So the music that plays in the background is No Place Like Home, I think.
Yeah.
And they're planning their future, and he leaves her. She's in an assayer's office, where money is. And two villains come along. They're going to hold up the office. And there's one guy who waits outside, one guy who goes in. And not only does he steal the loot, he also rapes and kills her. This is all sort of, presented to you in a very, as a sort of an inference, which makes it even more shocking in some ways. And Vern then decides that he's going to wreak his revenge. And so the rest of the movie, or the first part of the movie then, is like a detective story.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is told in flashback, where he's piecing together he's trying to find out who this guy is who's raped and killed his sweetheart, and eventually he ends up. In the process of this, and that's the complicated thing about the film. In the process of the backstory, you're introduced to Marlene Dietrich and this her story about how she set up this ranch, and the two things come together. When Vern meets Marlene Dietrich's lover, who's a gun fighting, he's the fastest drawer in the West, and this guy Frank, I think his name is Frank, he takes Vern to the Marlene Dietrich ranch, which is basically it doesn't really function as a ranch. It's basically a kind of a sanctuary for the cowboys, the bank robbers.
It's a front. It's a front. Clean.
So it allows them to escape the law, to become invisible from the law, so they can do their stealing. She takes 10% of the cut. They can hide out at the ranch, and it's all very. It's like a kind of a. It works by its own rules. It's off grid. She has three rules, in fact. She says, the three rules here are no fighting, no questions, so you never ask anyone where they've come from or where they've got stuff or who they are, and everybody has to pull their weight around the ranch, and that's pretty much it. What happens in the course of the film is that Vern turning up sort of upsets all of the relationships within this sort of villains community. And he does so, one, because he, well, you're never quite sure whether he sort of falls for Marlene Dietrich. I mean, I think you're led to believe that, you know, that she is this transgressive character, and actually she is the, she almost plays the role of the Indian in Fort Apache, that, you know, this is something you want, but you know is bad for you. You know, because she's so dangerous, she's not the kind of the homely woman that, that he would have married. She's this, this sort of independent, strong, self-willed, self-governed character. And his relationship, or her relationship with Vern, upsets the relationship she has with Frank. And that in turn has sort of ramifications on the rest of the villains' sort of respect for her, the way they see her. And eventually, I mean, you know, the story sort of, I mean, progresses. I mean, it's really about those relationships to me. I mean, what happens in the film is that eventually Vern works out that one of the villains is the guy who, I mean, he mistakes him at first.
Yeah.
But he works out that he's the, one of the villains is the guy who kills, who has killed his sweetheart, and he's going to kill him. And he uses his time at the ranch basically to learn how to shoot. And that's how the film kind of plays out. But in the process of it, in the process of this sort of detective story, you have these really odd things being thrown into the film. So at one point, when Vern first meets Frank, so these are the two sort of lead male characters, they're locked up in prison, and they're put in a cell. This is during an election. I mean, you're just told. I mean, this is so random. You're told that there's an election going on in the town that they've been thrown into jail in, and the cell next to them is taken by three corrupt politicians who, because of their corruption, are facing lynching. They're going to be killed, depending on the result of the election. But what happens is that, I mean, they all kind of get out. But one of the scenes that you see is outside of the jailhouse, outside the sheriff's office, the result of the election is called, and the Citizens' Party gets something like, I don't know, 15 votes or something. And the Law and Order Party, they get 1,500 votes. And this is the green light then to hang the corrupt politicians.
Yeah.
Well, this never happens, and nothing ever comes of it. It's just kind of thrown into the film for you to then, you know, again, sort of almost like join the dots. So what are we supposed to think about the relationship between, on the one hand, the civilizing process that's going on in the West, which is the creation of political parties, but that doesn't seem to be working out very well. the honor amongst thieves that Marlene Dietrich kind of represents. And then there are these other characters, you know, who are the sheriffs, who are always out to hunt down the robbers and the villains. But you don't know whether they're good or not, because actually, I mean, you know, they're given a drink by Marlene Dietrich, they're easily sort of fobbed off. They're not really sort of, they don't seem to be very keen on sort of enforcing the law, and not very effective. So the effective power is with the villains in the film, and the honour amongst the villains, if you like, is embodied in the end by the way that the two main lead characters, the male characters, I mean, it becomes a buddy-buddy movie at the end.
It does.
Ride off into the sunset together. So for me, there was this kind of sandwiching of the film. You've got these two women either end of the film, and things don't work out well for either of them. And then you get these two men who carry the weight of the film, really, both outside the law, both representing different kinds of justice, and both in the end coming to some kind of agreement or relationship, which sees them win out.
Yeah, no, yeah, I think that's all right. The other character, they call him Frenchie. I don't remember what his name is. It might be Frank, but they call him Frenchie.
That's it. He's the guy. He's Marlene Dietrich's longtime admirer.
Yes, and the way he meets her is by in a town filled with corruption and in which people are just, you know, using her for her sexuality.
Yeah.
He saves her and then, you know, offers to protect her, and she's like, fine, come in, you know, like, fine, this is, you know, I understand the deal here. It's sex for protection.
Yeah.
And he says, well, ma'am, of course I'll come in tomorrow morning when I'm done protecting you to lead you to the stage. Like, he is an honorable man. And you're right that the sheriffs in this movie, there's no question for a few of the sheriffs that we meet that they're generally vaguely good, but they're not very effective. We also meet the sheriff who works for the Citizens Party. That guy is an out and out.
Yeah, he's just corrupt.
Yeah, he's trying.
But he also incompetent.
Yes, he's trying to break the corrupt politicians out, and he accidentally gives the heroes the pick or key or whatever it is that they need to break out. I'll mention again, I'll put this in the show notes. We'll spoil this movie as well. The other thing that that popped into my mind from like a film historical thing is in these noir films, which by the 50s, a lot of Westerns are noir inflected. So again, a woman is murdered, a man goes on a search, whatever. There's traditionally what has been called since at least the 40s, the femme fatale, the woman who, and this is, I'm sorry, if you haven't seen a film noir from the 40s or 50s now, listen, I'm going to spoil all of them for you. The woman is actually the villain.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's just how it is. It doesn't matter if it's Barbara Stanwyck or Lana Turner or whoever. Sometimes she's very mysterious and appears villainous. Sometimes she appears on the up and up and totally virtuous, but by the end of that film, she will be revealed to have been a nefarious double demer. Every once in a while, she finds redemption in the in the love, but normally she does not find redemption. Either she is killed as punishment for being evil, or in some of the darker ones, she survives and our hero dies, and it's revealed that, you know, crime does pay. Well, in this movie, Marlene Dietrich is an obvious villain, and it's our hero, Vern or whatever his name is, who is operating nefariously, posing as a thief when he's actually a vigilante, seducing and deceiving her, just as the femme fatale normally seduces and deceives the detective, and the person who gets shot and dies precisely because she has done the right thing and tried to leave behind a life of crime and bring the killers to justice is Marlene Dietrich. So it is a reverse.
It is a complete reversal. Fatale. That's right. But she's also so I think, you know, she's genuinely torn between her affections for the two heroes in the film. So, you know, and ultimately, of course, she takes the bullet for Frenchie, who I've called Frank, but whatever, it's Frenchie. So she remains loyal to him, even though I think, you know, she sees the possibility of a future with Vern. I don't know that he does, but she also represents a kind of an idea of love, which has been disappointed all this time, because as you say, she's been in the saloon, she's been a kind of, you know, the good time girl, as it were. And she meets two men who don't see her like that.
Mm-hmm.
Who see her differently. She's also, her honor is also demonstrated, if you like, by Vern when he confronts her and tells her the truth about the jewelry she's wearing, a one piece of that jewelry, you know, she doesn't know it, but he tells her, had been taken from his fiancée. So she's ended up with this loot that has cost another woman her life. And actually what Frenchie's response to that isn't to sort of like laugh and throw her head back and sort of say, I don't care. Her response to that is to say, right, I'm packing it all in.
Yeah.
I can't live with that.
Yeah. And this, I think this is another, these films are just so rich with political subtext. You're right. They've created a utopia. It works perfectly. But the, you know, whether it's like Athenian democracy, the utopia comes because they're sending raiding parties out to take wealth from other people. So among them, everything is fine, but murder and rape is the source of this wealth. Yeah. And she is because she has been, I mean, we're not told if she's raped, but she's been used sexually for money her entire life. And her deal is, you know, as long as she's in control of her own sexuality and her own place, she's going to let them do whatever they want in the outside world, and she gets a cut. And I do think you're right. There's this moment where she realizes that now the thing that she has fled from, the sexual degradation of women by men for money, she's now a part of it. And she has the awareness to say, no, I'm not keeping my freedom at the cost of the lives of other women.
Yeah. Yeah. So the second rule, in fact, which is don't ask questions. And she repeats this to Vern several times when he says, where did you get the brooch? Where did you get the brooch? Is that the rule is don't ask questions. And for all of this time, I mean, that rule has kind of enabled all of these sort of oddballs at the ranch to live this life of, you know, a kind of an egalitarian life. Because they don't ask what each of them are doing in order to secure the money that keeps this place going. And as soon as that question is asked, actually it collapses.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not self-sustaining. It's reliant on a whole system of murder and violence and corruption. I think.
Yeah, there are times in these Western movies where there's a sense that if the bad element can be removed, there's a farmer's, and by the bad element, it's usually capitalist ranchers. Mm. These are films that move it a little later. So the Apaches have been killed, and then there's you know, capitalist ranchers and like small town farmers, and the small town farmers want to live this like classic New England village life of the kind that de Tocqueville would have praised. Mm. And the ranchers want full-on capitalism and just their cows to roam everywhere and then to sell those cows to the railroad companies that will take them to Chicago. And Shane is that. That's what Shane is about, is about the townspeople forming a functional American John Dewey-approved community against rapacious capitalism. Mm. This film, that community is revealed to be just another form of rapacious capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also need to point out, this is something I didn't know. I looked it up. The murderer, the guy who he's hunting down, I should have re-looked up the actor's name, but I've already forgotten it. He is not in the credits because he was blacklisted after refusing to testify to the House Un-American Activities Committee. So
interesting.
We have Fritz Lang making this film in America because he had to flee the Nazis. And then the fourth or fifth billed guy is not billed at all because he had to flee the McCarthyite purges of Hollywood. So this is, you know, this is, I mean, Hollywood history and the left-wing tradition in Hollywood history, I'm very interested in it. I'm very interested in people like Fonda and John Garfield, who did their best to be at least democratic socialists or social democrats in Hollywood. And then of course there's that other legacy of Hollywood, the John Wayne types for whom, you know, John Wayne gives an interview to Life magazine in like 1970, and he's like, what's wrong with the world is that we're not colonizing Africa. And he says this in 1970. It's like, if they would just let us loose in Africa, where there's nothing for the young men to do, which the man's brain was totally addled, I guess, because he was a Hollywood actor, but he actually thought that he was a figure of who had civilized the world in this Rudyard Kipling way. It's remarkable. And I think Life Magazine had him on because the cover is called Confessions of a G-Rated Cowboy, because they're saying, like, John Wayne thinks that he killed Cochise, but in fact he played an actor. I'm sorry, he played a character who, in fact, doesn't kill Cochise either.
Yeah. He strongly backed Reagan, right? I mean, that's...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The man, his characters, I think I said this already, but his characters are often complicated, conflicted. John Ford makes most of these movies, and they're complicated and conflicted. John Wayne himself seems to have been not an interesting figure, just a sort of bland right wing, you know, spouter of talking point. He would be on Fox News, every night.
Yeah,
every night, John Wayne would be on Fox News if he were, if he were alive. He was that type.
But I mean, quickly go back to Rancho Notorious. I mean, one of the things that was sort of left hanging for me slightly was that, you know, so there is this aspiration that Verne has at the beginning to settle down and live this life with this woman, and they're going to have all these children they're planning, and I can't remember what she says she's going to call the farm they're going to have, but it's a very sort of utopian kind of name. And she is, I mean, she's just such a contrast to, I mean, everything that Marlene Dietrich is, she is not. And that goes not just for her, I mean, her physical appearance, which is very homely compared to Marlene Dietrich, but also, I mean, she doesn't exude any of the sort of the strength of the Dietrich character, or the, I mean, you see Dietrich sort of, you know, sitting on the fences in Levi's, and the first time Verne meets her, she's covered in oil because she's so, you know, she can do pretty much anything, and she can wear this, you know, she can glam up, and, you know, she is this completely different kind of woman. But the fact that that both of these women, or neither of these women, survive the film, I mean, is the implication of that, that his initial dream, that he gives up on that.
Yeah.
You know, he goes off with this other guy, and they're going to sort of, you know, they're gonna live a different kind of life. So it's almost like that whole kind of aspiration that's expressed at the beginning of the film is turned into a myth.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then this is, again, going back to Natty Bumppo, Shane, Ethan Edwards from The Searchers, what they all have in common is they cannot, because of their violence, because of their knowledge of the ways of the other, whether that's the savage other of the Apache and the Comanche, or the savage other of the outlaw, they are needed to fight the capitalists, or they're needed to fight the Comanche to save the white community, but there is no place for them in the white community. And I think there is a sense at the end of Rancho Notorious, it's not made explicit, that having become an outlaw in order to hunt outlaws, there's not going to be another woman in his life, and there's not going to be a little farm. When you do violence to protect the social order, it's a Hobbesian thing, I would say. The good news is you have protected and saved the social order. The bad news is your violence now has no place in that social order, except, you know, to act against other wrongdoers. And now you have to either remain as the pointy tip of the Leviathan, or you have to leave. You will never again, Cincinnati style, get to hang up the sword and be a farmer.
That's right.
That's gone.
Yeah, that's right. And equally, the other thing that's gone in the film, and I think that's emphasized by the way that Lang tells Marlene Dietrich's story in flashback, is that Wild West that she was a part of, right? I mean, you know, and it's such a reconstruction. I mean, that's also gone.
Yeah. Yeah, there's now prosperity.
Yeah.
And then there's people preying on that prosperity. But the bawdy, fun, reckless miners and cowhands just having money everywhere.
And the drunkenness.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's way too late for me to say this, but I should just say now, for those of you who haven't seen these movies, you know, people like John Wayne often play cowboys. The cowboy has become, in many ways, the like iconic white American figure, and actual cowboys were almost always teenagers, and it was a job that no one wanted to do. So well over half of cowboys were black, Mexican, or Indian. Mm. And this figure, this white man who knows his way around a gun, a horse, and a cow, and has civilized the West. It is a fascinating figure for us to talk about ideas of what America and civilization and savagery means in the 20th and 21st century. This is not a real person. This idea, there were gunfighters. I mean, gunfighters were real, but they were often, you know, more like bounty hunters, or they were breaking up unions. This romantic white figure of the middle-aged man who rides the prairie and dispenses justice. That is 100% false. And I should have said that. I should have said that to begin with, which to me, that's almost like a relief, because you can discuss these films for what they meant to the people who made them and the people who watched them. I mean, you don't have to get bogged down in the historical accuracy, because the historical accuracy is pretty much zero.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not there. This is what people imagined the 19th century to be. Even more, they were telling stories about what they wanted the 20th century to be, or what they were criticizing about the 20th century. And they're not, if you go to this movie and think, this is not how the Wild West was, you're right. You're right. They are not historical documents. Mm. They're historical documents now of the 30s, 40s, 50s. I think that's everything I wanted to cover.
They were good films to put together, actually. I mean, they are quite different. I was thinking, you know, I was going to say, you know, they're kind of atypical Westerns. And then I sort of wondered, well, I'm not sure what a typical Western is. And it's interesting that, that we all kind of have this idea of the cowboy and the Wild West and the justice and all the rest of it. But actually, you know, typical Western, that's harder to pin down.
I don't think there is a typical Western. I can come up with a few archetypes, and I do think there's a sort of right-wing archetype, which is defeat the savages, and then there's the left-wing archetype, which is defeat the capitalists. And both of these stories are told multiple times, and the thing they have in common is that, as I mentioned, the man who does the violence does not belong in the community afterwards. Mm. I just realized one last thing. So I read a novel I'd never read before. It's called Warlock by a man named Oakley Hall. And it was written in 1958, and then it was turned into a Western, which I haven't seen, with Henry Fonda. But one of the characters there, it's a mythological story of the West. And one of the characters, they've tried to create their own law and order. They've got a judge who doesn't have any real power, but he acts as a judge. And they've hired a gunslinger to try and keep the people safe, even though he is a gunslinger. And now I have to see if I can. So that's the question, really, as the story goes on. It's like, that's actually what this book is about, is what do you do with the gunslinger? Mm. Good news, he will shoot the gunslingers. Bad news, he's a gunslinger. So, like, did you do something good or not? So, after things have gotten better because they've hired this gunslinger, he writes, "Poor and makeshift our efforts may be, yet there would seem proof in them that a society of sorts is possible in an anarchistic state." "We feel we are ultimately in the Republic, separated from her only by an incredibly inept and laggard territorial government, and so obedience to the forms is necessary. Or are these forms themselves so ineradicably embedded in men's minds that we cannot think but in terms of them? So that is a Western novel from 1958, explicitly calling the Western town an anarchistic form of community, and then asking whether or not the forms of law and order are required in order to bring about the justice. So it was, at least in one writer's mind,
it was
the active question of anarchy was there. And I wanted to bring that to our attention. I had no idea. I read this book sometime between our two meetings in the UK and was shocked. Shocked to find the Western town, it's anarchistic. The government is not there, and yet order emerges.
Yeah.
So there we have
emergent.
It.
Emergent. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great place to end.
Wonderful. Ruth, let's do it again next year, okay?
Yeah, it was really good fun.
Wonderful. All right, we'll do something besides Westerns, though. I promise, listeners. Thank you, Ruth. Such a pleasure.